Welcome back to Hardware Unboxed for part two of the December Q&A series. Part one's already on the channel. Go watch that, except after this video, so you don't destroy our YouTube stats. But if you are keen on watching more questions or starting to watch questions, let's get into it. But before we do...
Today's sponsor spot is brought to you by Gigabyte and their Radeon RX 7800 XT Gaming OC 16G graphics card. The Gaming OC is one of the most affordable 7800 XTs on the market, but don't let the price fool you. It's powerful, offering outstanding 1440p and even 4K gaming performance in demanding next-generation titles. Now, keeping the Gaming OC cool and quiet is the WinForce cooling system featuring a large copper base plate with multiple heat pipes. Then dissipating the extracted heat are three 90mm fans, and to reduce turbulence and therefore operating volume, the centrally located fan spins in the reverse direction. It also features a dual BIOS and power indicators, so for more information, please check the link in the video description. All right, Tim, what prices do you think the Super Series refresh will release at? And which is the highest price you'd consider reasonable? I always hate those questions, but thank you for the question. This is assuming that the intent is for the 4070 Super and 4070 Ti Super to replace the 4070 Ti and 4080 respectively. So
not sure that's what they'll be aiming for. Not sure they'll be going, let's replace the 4070 Ti with the 4070 Super, because that will be...
I think last Q&A I said something along the lines of I expected to be similar to what we saw with the 20 series. So they'll replace them at the existing price points, and then those vanilla models, let's say, will filter down a bit in price, and where they get phased out over time, I don't know. But I think...
Yeah, I think that's probably more likely to happen, especially because the rumors aren't suggesting like a huge improvement in terms of performance. So if they were trying to sell like a card that's only 5 or 10% faster, that's, let's say, the 4070 Super, 5 or 10% faster, more at the price of a 4070 Ti, that card would be horrific. Probably one of the worst releases ever. So that's probably going to happen. I don't know. Probably not going to happen. I wouldn't have thought so. I think it's more likely they'll be priced around the same.
So we're saying MSRP, so 4070 Ti Super, that'll be $800. And then the standard 4070 Super, which I think is probably going to be the biggest upgrade in terms of performance and what it's getting, minus the VRAM, of course, that'll be $600. What should they be? And when you say what should they be, what should they be in our little fantasy land where GPU prices are what they used to be, or sort of in the current climate of GPU? Because I think in the current climate, $600, I mean, what should it be?
Depends how much faster it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
If it's like 20% faster and it costs $600, I mean, what's the 4070 now? You can get that for as low as like 520, like, maybe, 550 is pretty typical. So if you're looking at 20% more performance, $600, that wouldn't be awful.
It's a reasonable refresh,
reasonable. I think the 4070 Ti is probably one of the least well-priced current products.
Because you want it closer to $500, but then if we say that you're restructuring the entire lineup, which isn't going to happen.
Yeah, so. I guess it depends, like, how bad is the current lineup? Like, is the current pricing of something like a 4070 unreasonable? I think now it's closer to $500. It's not that unreasonable. It seems probably one of the better products that you can get today in that range. So, if they're sort of matching that value, it's probably not terrible. But then I would expect like a 4070 Ti Super that's only slightly better than a 4070 Ti. I didn't think $800 for a 4070 Ti was a particularly great price.
Yeah.
So if it's only slightly better at the same price, is that...
That's right. I'd want that product more like $750, I guess, in the current lineup, and that's accounting for the extra VRAM that we suspect it's getting.
Yeah, so that probably fixes a little bit of that product.
Yeah, because $800 for a 12GB card was laughably bad. I'll say I'd like it to be $750, but it's likely going to be $800. But of course, we have no idea. We'll have to wait until the announcement, which I think is on the 8th of January. We don't have any of the details officially yet, so I suppose we can talk about it.
Well, I think that's when the CES sort of...
That's when we've been guessing this will happen. And whether or not they release the pricing information at that point in time, which I suspect they would, because there's not much else to announce, really.
Unless, like, AMD, they do, like, a last-minute price cut, or they cut prices in between the announcement and the release. That's the only thing that they might try and respond to. But yeah, I can't imagine there'll be too much of that. And a lot of these products, like the 4070 Ti Super, I guess it's competing with the 7900 XT a little bit, the 4080 Supers, what, like XTX, and they've already had some price adjustments there for those products. Like the 7900 XT has come down to more like $750. So a lot of that price movement has probably already happened. So I don't know. Yeah, I would expect that, yeah, the pricing to come out probably around then, and we'll get a pretty good idea. But, you know, I can't see this being like everyone saying GPU prices are bad. I'm waiting for the next really good pricing thing. Come on, guys. It's not. This is not going to be that.
No. All right. This comment says, I have a 5800X3D on a B350 motherboard, which has a PCIe 3.0 times 16 slot. Indeed, it does. How far can I push this combo without appreciable performance loss. I nearly choked when I said that. Currently using a 2070 Super, but I'm thinking about upgrading to a 7800 XT or 4070 Super, which I imagine both of those would be quite a substantial upgrade, but off the top of my head, I'll take your word for it. So how much performance loss will there be using either of those cards on PCIe 3.0? Zero, basically. If you're gaming at 1440p, especially zero, the only time you might see maybe up to like a 10% performance loss would be 1080p, super duper high frame rates. But yeah, basically, PCIe has yet to be a big issue for graphics cards. So your B350 motherboard will support even a 4090. And look, there is definitely a game or two where the performance loss will be a bit bigger than that. But by and large, it's next to nothing, if not nothing. So, and with the GPUs you're talking about, not a problem at all. So you can put whatever on that board and you'll get close enough to maximum performance.
Cool.
How will you review the performance of games in the future that maybe have technology like FSR3 frame generation built into them in a way that you cannot disable it? It's fully integrated into the coding of the game. I'm sure that at some point, especially with demanding Unreal Engine 5 games, this might happen at some point. I'll probably consider retiring. I'm getting to that age now. So yeah, that would suck, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean,
unless it got really, really good.
I can't see that happening simply because, first of all, the visual side of things, unless, as you say, they sort of make it extremely good. But also there's a performance benefit to not using frame generation in most scenarios, simply because it has to generate the future frame to then interpolate the frame in the middle of the two frames. You're sort of getting half a frame additional latency from using frame generation most of the time. So,
and to be clear, we believe it to be a smoothing technology, not a performance boosting technology.
Yeah, I mean, it does. Which,
because people will be confused that you're saying it reduces performance despite the frame rate being essentially doubled.
Yeah, I mean performance from the latency side of things. Mm. The latency is about half a frame greater at the same frame rate with frame generation, simply because it has to, again, it generates the future frame on the GPU. So it renders a real future frame. Then it generates the interpolated frame and shows you that frame immediately. So you're effectively about half a frame behind with rendering by using frame generation at the same frame rate as native rendering. So when you've got frame generation impacting performance in that way, I think you're not going to have it as a default option, because you will have people that will prefer the non-frame generation better latency experience. At least I would assume that, yeah, this will be a feature you can toggle on or off, especially with the visual side of things as well. Like, there are going to be configurations, lower frame rates are going to be more impacted by visual issues. It's going to be less likely you'll want to use frame generation at, say, 40, 50 FPS. It's not going to look amazing at those sort of frame rates. So, yeah, I can't imagine this will be like a always turned on feature. You know, we've seen, you know, even with, there's probably only one game I can think of that even forces you to use upscaling, and that's Alan Wake 2, where you have to choose between FSR or DLSS. And that really hasn't impacted, you know, benchmarking all that much, because FSR runs on all GPUs. So if you want to do apples to apples benchmarking, you can still just use FSR as the native solution. You just run it at the native frame rate. You just say, well, we're using FSR effectively as anti-aliasing. and that's all good. I imagine if FSR3 frame generation was the default for some bizarre, stupid reason in a game, first of all, no one would buy that game and it would be a massive flop. But on top of that, you would just use that as the, you know, the option across all GPUs and you'd benchmark it like that. So, yeah, again, it scales pretty similarly across GPUs. So, you know, if it's like we're showing you 120 FPS, but it's actually rendering at 60 FPS, that would scale across all the GPUs. So the lower the native render rate is, the, you know, it just effectively would be doubled across all those FSR3 configurations. So, yeah, I can't see that. I don't think that will be like a default thing, maybe on consoles, but yeah, not on PC. PC gamers, you know, we've seen things like the smallest graphical features that aren't included in games, and people just, you know, they go straight to Steam. They're slamming the negative reviews, dislikes. Like, it's just not going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah.
Yeah, good answer, I think, but I'm going to stick with retirement.
Yeah, fair enough.
What's the most exciting PC component / peripheral release you are currently looking forward to? I get asked this stuff a lot. Like, you know, what are you most excited for next year? And for me, it's always pretty simple. I'm all about the CPUs and GPUs. That's the stuff that excites me the most. Peripherals and stuff like that, not so much. I'm always, you know, I'm pretty keen on like a 32-inch OLED panel, for example, for my gaming rig.
Well, that's definitely coming next year.
So I mean, I'm very excited for that. But I mean, the current monitor I've got is very good. I'm excited probably in terms of components for GPUs. Like, I'm hoping there's things improve a bit where we can get excited about builds and all that sort of stuff and reignites my interest a bit in the industry, because this generation's been a bit crap, to say the least. Like, it gets boring to the point where you're just whinging about how bad all the options are. And, you know, all my systems have 4090s in them because that's like the best you're the same, right? It's the most exciting GPU of the generation, and it's more than $1,600 US. And that's another example of a product selling for more than the MSRP for the most part, certainly in a region such as Australia. So while I love how powerful a 4090 is, and it's a product I really enjoy using, I don't love the fact that most people watching the content can't afford one, and most of my friends can't justify spending that kind of money on one. So it kind of sucks your enthusiasm out of it when most people can't enjoy what you're enjoying. And sure, there's always been expensive premium high-end products, but you've been able to get the more modest mid-range stuff and still get a really great experience, like a big performance uplift. But we're seeing stuff like 4060s, similar to 3060s, and 4060 Ti's being embarrassingly bad. And, you know, even the 7800 XT, it's like, that's probably the most exciting product we got, and it's a 6800 XT at a better price. So,
yeah, I mean, like, if it came to next generation GPUs and I was thinking about, like, what would excite me the most, it would not be a product that's 50% faster than the 4090. That'd be cool, but what would really get me interested is a product that's 50% faster that's $300. So it's like the same, it's the same cost as what we had previously for like a 4060, but it's way better.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That would get me way more interested.
I laugh, like,
that would
because be, I agree, but I'm just like, yeah.
Well. I mean, that's absolutely not going to happen. And I'm saying, bookmark me saying this and throw it in my face when it happens, if it happens, because it won't happen. There's no way. It's not happening next generation, at least from NVIDIA. So
that
would get me very excited. That would be like an amazing new product that would really, I think, reinvigorate PC hardware for people. I don't think it's terrible at the moment. There's been a bit more interest towards the end of the year than there was maybe this time last year, I think, in terms of hardware, because, I don't know, there's been a few more improvements. But, yeah, I'm thinking of things like, again, like Zen 5 CPUs would be interesting. But for me, it wouldn't be so much the performance that those products are bringing. It's like, how's that going to impact, like, $150 to $200 CPUs? Is that going to mean that AM5 products, like a 7600, for example, are now actually really good for those budget entry-level builders? It's sort of teetering on the, do you buy AM4, do you buy AM5 for budget builders? And there's the potential for like a next generation series to really make it that, you know, the new platform is the way to go for a budget builder. And that's going to, yeah, improve a lot of things, because we're seeing more, I think, more scenarios these days where you can run into CPU bottlenecks in the latest games, even at reasonably high resolutions and quality settings, Starfield being examples on some of those, you know, Unreal Engine open world games. You know, there are CPU limitations there. So, I think those sort of things would get me excited. As well, you know, seeing the evolution of a feature like, can FSR get a lot better? Can FSR 3 get a lot better? Can XCSS? I just did a video looking at XCSS and I was quite impressed with it. How's that going to go? Like, is that going to be a nice, really viable solution for people moving forward in more games? You know, those sorts of things I think would get me excited about next year on top of the monitor stuff that you already brought up. So, yeah, I think there's some things to look forward to next year. We'll see how it goes.
All right, here's a really interesting question that we haven't really talked about because I guess it's somewhat personal, but also we're pretty transparent about this stuff, especially with our Discord float playing community. We talk about this stuff live a lot. But anyway, it's been asked. So
it was heavily upvoted as well, so I think a lot of people are interested.
Okay. I guess people just want to know if I actually pay you.
Yeah,
so
I guess.
The answer is no. Tim is a slave, but it's just because he likes monitors so much. I'm like, look, I can feed your addiction. I will get you all the monitors you want. You just have to make content for me. And he went for that.
Monitors, very Moorish.
So anyway, the question is, just curious, how do you guys split the channel revenue between each other? Like, whoever worked on that video gets the AdSense/sponsor money, or is it split down the middle for everything? Yeah, I mean, it'd be very difficult to do the first one and
we need to hire an accountant to really work all that stuff out.
Yeah. No, essentially the way it worked was back when the channel was much smaller and I was trying to build it up to make this a job, because for a long time, while I enjoyed doing this, it didn't pay all of the bills. And then Tim was at TechSpot. We met each other through both, just by pure coincidence, we both happened to be in Australia in the same state, only hours apart from each other. So we caught up. Tim was dabbling with video for TechSpot. I said to Tim, you know, are you interested in coming over to Harbour Unboxed? And then I'm like, so how does that work? Because the first challenge you've got is you can't really pay someone just a regular wage, no matter how sort of good that wage is, because, well, I mean, I guess you could, but if I paid you a wage and Tim had a flat wage or whatever, and, you know, he negotiated that each year, you get to the point where Tim's really well known in the industry. He does his monitors. He might as well just split off and do Monitors Unboxed by himself, if you get what I mean. Like, it doesn't really work having a co-host that just gets paid a wage, whereas you get... Am I explaining this well enough?
Yeah, you're basically saying, like, if you were getting all the profit from the channel and you're paying me a wage, there'd probably be, well, a discrepancy there.
There's no incentive for you to work for me.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Like, I'm effectively building a brand for myself on the channel.
Mm-hmm.
And then if you're undervaluing that, then there's, I guess, a risk that I would have left and done something. And that would have then hurt you, because all the stuff that I was making that you're not willing to do, like monitors, would be then I'd just be making all the profit, I guess, and revenue from
that. Yeah, and I could look at getting someone to replace you, but it's just a never-ending revolving door. And if you've got someone who's really valuable and can do the job, and to be clear, like, Tim does the full job himself, which is really valuable. So it's not like if you were just a presenter and there was someone else that did all the testing and did the script, then your value is a lot less. So if you were just a presenter, I'd be more inclined to just pay you a wage, because you can't really go and do Monitors Unboxed by yourself, because you need all the other stuff. So to answer the question, I approached him, we talked back, and basically I knew straight away how the only way this would work. And so I offered Tim a revenue split from the get-go, which Tim was really pleased with. Took me up on that one, and then I had to go away and actually make enough money so the revenue split was enough for Tim. So I don't know how long it was, but I remember I didn't sleep much for at least a year. And then, yeah, Tim came on board and we did the revenue split, and we do that. The revenue split is across all Hardware Unboxed / Monitor Unboxed / anything under the brand, which is everything we do. So it's all split that way, and that's worked out really well now for... how many years have we done this for?
Yeah, I mean, there hasn't really been too much change in that scenario since the beginning, really. We sort of planned to do a few things here and there, but it's just worked out really nicely in the end, I think. You know, at the start, you know, when we were sort of trying to make Hardware Unboxed a viable business, and certainly you'd put in a lot of work, and then I joined, we tried to push it even harder. The split wasn't, you know, I think each of us probably would have, if we'd gone away and did, you know, just a day job, we probably would have been, at least for the work that we were putting in,
yeah,
we would have been earning a lot more money if we were like in an engineering job or something like that. But certainly over time, the splits worked out really well. And, you know, the channel's got to a point where that's not really, you know, I'm not sitting here being like, oh, I'm desperate to change up that scenario. It's,
it's been
working out pretty well. So, yeah, that's how it works, basically. Yeah, I think a few people in the comments of this question were sort of saying, I'm sure that it's like I'm a salaried employee or something, but
no, it doesn't work. If you're doing that, anyone who's doing, who is a salary employee that basically produces all of the content without needing anyone else, they're doing it the wrong way. Like if you're working for a YouTube channel and just getting paid, like you'd have to be getting paid, especially if it's a big channel, you'd have to be getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year for it to be worthwhile. And you look at a lot of the guys that work for Linus, they're more presenters, a lot of the guys. Like, they're not doing all the benchmarking.
Well, it's a team job to make those videos, right?
That's
right. It's like they've got an editor that will, they've got a full-time editor.
Someone does B-roll.
Someone does B-roll, someone does sales. They've got camera operators, script writers. So it becomes more of a production. And if you're running a production, you're going to have a different pay structure. But I guess it just depends on, like, how much, like, how could someone generate this brand by themselves? And I think we've even seen this across other media brands. Like, eventually it comes to a point where the people that are producing the content, like what's actually going out, what are people reading? Are they known? Is everyone known for that sort of the style and the production of that content? They sort of figure out, hey, well, we're getting paid X amount of money, and then we're just shoveling money into the owner or executive's pockets that isn't really known and isn't really doing anything except owning the brand and it has invested in it, I guess. And then they eventually figure out that, you know, if the working conditions aren't great, or, you know, they're not getting paid enough, or there's another opportunity for them, that they'll even just form a group and just leave and create their own brand. And we've seen that across, even just recently, there's been a few gaming brands, like, you know, game journalists and those things, that were working for, you know, some group of people, and then they're like, hey, we can go this our own way, do it our own thing. We can have full control. We can sort of be owners of the business. And that's a lot more appealing to people, right? Which I think is why, as you say, you sort of figured out very early that that's, in this sort of business and scenario, that's the only real way that sort of thing is going to be viable, and sort of mitigates that risk of you know, not that I was ever sitting here being like, I'm going to work for Hardware Unboxed and then make a brand for myself, then split off and do my own thing and sort of use you in that way. Like, I was never thinking of doing that, but who knows?
Well, like, I can go both ways. Like, the way we've set up now, it's a win-win for everyone. It's beneficial for everyone. And when it's a win-win for everyone, it's always successful. When it's a situation where the channel you came on, I don't know, 100,000, I can't remember what it was. It was somewhere around there. And now we've got a million subscribers and we're getting a lot more views, and the brand makes a lot more money. So if your wage had only gone up slightly, but mine had gone up massively, and we were doing the same amount of work, I can see how that could be annoying for someone. I mean, it is what it is. That's how a lot of businesses are run. But then once we've spent 7+ years working together and we've got this thing, then Tim might be like, well, you know, I'm at a point now where I can easily just spin off and do my own thing.
We see that a lot with trades as well, right?
Like,
people will become an apprentice, and then they'll work for a business, and then eventually it gets to the point where they're like, okay, well, it's,
they know all the business inside out.
They know how to do it. So they
become a competitor.
And they become their own business. So, yeah, I think this is a great setup, and I certainly am very – I like seeing when other businesses go down this path as well, when you see other people in sort of media-focused businesses sort of going, yeah, let's be an owner-operated sort of, you know, co-op sort of style business. I think it's really nice to see people doing that in a successful way, that sort of go their own way and do that. And that's sort of what we've done. We're independent. We're not owned by, you know, some big publishing house. I think that's been really beneficial for us as a channel to do the content that we want to make. And, yeah, I can't be happier with the structure and how things have worked out for Hardware Unboxed. I think it's been going really well. So,
yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed we can do it for another. I don't even know how many years we've been doing it for now, but
I
should work that out.
I finished uni in 2017, which is when I came on at the end of 2017 full time. So it's been six years now for me, and a few years longer for you. So it's been a journey, I guess.
Has it ever? Is HDR impacting FPS noticeably? And is it really worth enabling on a good TV/monitor? I already know your answer to this one because you go on about HDR like
this. It's pretty good. So, yeah, like performance side of things, I've seen this comes up occasionally, especially on monitor reviews, people saying, like, does HDR cause a performance hit in terms of FPS in games? No, is the answer to that. It was the case with, I think it was like Pascal GPUs maybe at the time that HDR was sort of coming. There was some sort of pipeline issue there where HDR did cause a small performance hit. Current GPUs, not an issue at all. You'll get the same performance whether you are running HDR on or off. So if you've got a good quality monitor and it can run HDR, it's effectively free visual improvement. So it's kind of like going from like low settings to ultra settings, except that there's no actual performance hit on the GPU. However, you're going to have to get a good monitor to access HDR. So it's kind of like...
So how many pillars of HDR does it need?
Yeah, get all three.
All three, okay.
And you're going to have to spend money, obviously, to buy a good quality HDR monitor. So it's like, you can say it's free from the GPU side of things, but it's not really free because you probably will have to upgrade your monitor. But yeah, if you've got the hardware, it's certainly worth enabling. And the fact that it doesn't come with that performance yet on the GPU is pretty nice. So yeah.
All right, Tim. Do you think general consumers are actually interested in software that's AI accelerated and taking into account when buying products like laptops? Are people just jaded by the unfulfilled promises of stuff like smart assistants that they just don't care? Do they have any interest in hardware or software that uses AI technology? So are people hyped about AI? If they see AI on a laptop or something, are they more inclined to buy it?
I think this is like, there's kind of a couple ways to look at this because like AI has been very diluted in terms of like what AI means. Like there's actual AI features. I'm thinking like ChatGPT is one example that that's sort of what people would be thinking of when they think of AI. But then there's AI that is basically just someone's coded like an if-then statement sort of thing, which is very basic. And we've seen that there's been so many examples of things that have AI in them, but that AI is not really any AI at all, really. So, you know, I think consumers, it comes down to like what the feature's actually doing. Like, I don't think people are interested in having something that's branded AI or like, oh, I must have like AI. You know, there's obviously groups of hype people that are interested in those things.
Yeah.
I'm thinking more of like general people interested in like, what can something do for them? Like, I've got a task that needs to be done. What's the best way of doing this? And if AI is the best way of doing that, then they're going to use that tool. But if AI is not the best way of doing it, then they're not going to bother with it. It's all like the outcome of things. So yeah, I think people are just excited to have things improve. But I think a lot of AI tools aren't really run on client systems, are they? Like ChatGPT is run in the cloud. So you don't really need like a super powerful AI processor that you've got like in your house to run something like ChatGPT. You just pay for them to use the server, basically. So I guess if there's more features that are like using AI, you know, across, you know, we've seen, you know, Premiere and Photoshop, things that we use, you know, integrating more and more AI features that do actually use your local processing hardware, then I guess it's interesting. But it depends, again, it depends on what it's doing for you. And I think there's a lot of things that I haven't seen to be, at least for my workflow, overly useful. Like it's kind of, if you've got a niche thing or a fringe thing, it's like, might enhance it a little bit. But yeah, just depends, I guess. I imagine as time goes on, it's only going to become more and more important. Like they're going to figure out more and more ways to make AI tools genuinely useful. And we're going to get less of those if-then statement AI solutions where they sort of slap AI on something that doesn't really do that at all. So yeah, we'll keep checking it out as things go on. More AI processing, I guess. Maybe you'll have to start benchmarking something like that in the future.
Maybe. All right, Tim, because you do all the monthly GPU pricing updates, you'll have some really good insight into this one. I expect a long-winded answer with lots of insights. Do you think NVIDIA will have normal GPU prices again or not because AI is carrying them and they don't need to worry about budget GPU buyers?
Yeah, I mean, it all hinges on like what someone means when they say like normal GPU prices. You're talking about like normal for now, or you're talking about normal for 5 years ago, normal for cryptocurrency mining times. Your normal can mean a whole bunch of different things.
I'd like to go back 5 years, please.
Yeah.
Five years?
I think that's what most people mean, right? Like they mean 5 years ago when GPU pricing was a lot better. I think the days of that are pretty much over, done, not going to return for a number of reasons. And I think, you know, they're gonna hide behind things like inflation a little bit to sort of say, well, you know, a lot of things are more expensive these days. But I think a lot of it is just that they've figured out that gamers do actually pay more for GPUs and they're willing to do so. So there's no incentive for them to, you know, produce those really good value $200 GPUs anymore. I think the days of that, you know, it's unfortunately done, but, you know, there's still a chance that future products will produce better value. There will be better value products in the future, at least compared to today's products. So, yeah, I mean, there's a chance that the next generation will improve things like cost per frame. I think the more generations you go without improving things like value, the longer people will be waiting between upgrade cycles. And, you know, we always talk about competition, things like, you know, it's up to AMD to produce competitive products so that NVIDIA is incentivized to lower prices. That's certainly one way that pricing would improve. And we have seen things like the 7800 XT cause NVIDIA to reduce the price of a 4070. They dropped it by, it's not an official price cut, but it's effectively $50 cheaper now. It can be up to $80 to $100 cheaper. Mm-hmm. That was directly in response to AMD producing a product. But NVIDIA is also competing against themselves and buyers of older GeForce GPUs. If they still want to get sales in the gaming division, they need to convince someone that's got a pretty reasonable GeForce GPU that the new product is worth buying. So if they're continuing to just keep the same cost per frame year over year, someone that's bought a $300 GPU is then faced with, you know, it's the same money is getting you nothing a few years later, and then they may be faced with having to spend $400 or $500 or $600 to get that performance increase over time. And a lot of buyers are not willing to do that. So if they're not getting enough people who are willing to spend more money interested in buying GPUs, no one is going to be buying GPUs.
Mm-hmm.
GeForce owners who are only interested in buying new GeForce products are just going to be like, well, my current product is effectively the same as newer products, I'm not going to bother. And that's obviously going to have sales implications. So, you know, I think things that we've seen in the past are things like NVIDIA with the Turing generation. They kind of did what we've seen from the 40 series. You know, we've talked about it being sort of a features generation, mm-hmm. releasing things like ray tracing DLSS. The 40 series has been about frame generation. They've tried that. I don't know how successful those generations have been compared to something like a 10 series or 30 series, but, you know, they've corrected the generation after to sort of go, well, you know, we got a certain number of people buying a product that offered the same performance, but we kind of have saturated that market. Like, there's only so far we can take that, so now we have to kind of offer something a bit different. So, yeah, I think there's going to be improvements to these things, but as for like normal pricing from 5 years ago, where you could routinely buy $200 GPUs that were really compelling, where the top end cards were like $700 to $800 max,
mm-hmm.
that's not the market anymore. PC gaming is a lot bigger. You talked a lot about that in previous Q&As about how many more people are playing PC games, which just expands the range of, you know, price points that people have budgets mm-hmm. for. So, yeah, that's not going to happen anymore. But, yeah, I think there will be some improvements to value to some degree with the future generation. They can't leave it for too long. But we'll see. We'll see what happens. Right now, my main curiosity for you guys is, why didn't Intel send you a Meteor Lake system for review? Are they that scared of you? And will you be testing Meteor Lake when you're able to get your hands on a system with it? So, no, this isn't like an Intel not sampling us situation. There's been companies in the past that have not sampled us products that we did want to test. This is not one of those situations. The main reason being that Meteor Lake is only in laptops at the moment, and we've pretty much just discontinued our laptop testing just for a variety of reasons. I think channels like Jared's Tech, for example, are able to do much more in-depth laptop testing that covers a lot more laptops, so laptop models. And the way that we were sort of testing was trying to generalize performance to different chips, but it became super hard when, you know, all the different vendors would be tuning their products and have wildly different performance. Then it just becomes so difficult to test a CPU, like a new laptop CPU comes out and you have to test a dozen different laptops and they all have different power limits and you have to, it becomes a real nightmare. And I think the way that Jared's Tech's approached it, where, you know, you will be buying laptops as laptop products, so you test the laptops as they are and you can see how they perform relative to other laptops. We didn't really have the time to do stuff like that. So, yeah, as time went on, we sort of just figured, well, our time is better focused on other things like Monitors Unboxed, for example. And then on the gaming laptop side of things, I don't think Meteor Lake's been too too much of a push into gaming laptops just yet, but, you know, I find it hard to recommend a gaming laptop as a product. I would much prefer to game on a desktop. I think they're a much better product for gaming. So to be spending a lot of time testing a product that you don't really believe in, sorry, Jared, is, yeah, I think it's probably better for the people who are passionate about gaming laptops and see the use cases in them to do that sort of testing. So if you're interested in Media Lake testing, there's a lot of good channels out there that do that sort of testing. Again, Jared's Tech, I believe they got their hands on some Media Lake systems. You'll have all the information there. And then when Media Lake comes across to desktops, we will be all over it. So that's that situation.
Do we think AMD will make a 7500 XT? God, I hope not. Well, they've got no smaller RDNA 3 dies. Mm-hmm. So the 7600 is based on a monolithic die, so there's no, like, you know, memory modules on that one, which would mean the smallest die is the one they're currently using for the 7600. There is a cut-down version sold as a mobile part, so that's the 7600S.
Right. So, yeah, any 7500 XT would be something like that, like a cut-down
so
version.
So it's 13% fewer cores. We obviously don't know the price because it's a laptop part. But, yeah, I don't think they're going to make one.
Yeah,
I don't think so. Because, basically, yields would have to be pretty bad for them to make it right.
I would have thought so. Yeah, I mean, like, they made the 6500 XT previously because they had the lower die, which they were selling.
Well, they're opportunistic there.
Yeah, they were like, that's probably more designed for laptops. But then they're like, let's
make bank on this garbage silicon. That's what they were thinking. They were like,
so a 7500 XT, if they did make it, wouldn't be as bad as that, theoretically, because the die isn't so heavily restricted and limited.
Well, that's if it was based on the same silicon as the 7600.
So, yeah, I mean, that would be the viable option. But, yeah, I just don't think that that would happen.
I agree.
More likely is they will just lower the price of the 7600 as it currently stands and go with that.
Mm-hmm.
All right, we're hitting pause for the second time because, again, YouTube algorithm reasons. We talked in depth about those algorithm reasons in part one, so we won't recap that here.
Our hands are tied.
Absolutely, we are slaves. But anyway, what else? We've got Patreon Float Plane, 20% club. If you've been watching to the end, really appreciate that. You can sign up, support the channel, which I guess it doesn't really support making these episode specifically, but it's more the testing stuff.
It's emotional support.
Yeah, it's emotional support. When the numbers go up, we get happier and happier. You know?
I'm like, yes, I'm going to benchmark. The next 10 hours won't be a problem.
Exactly. So that's what it's all about. We buy some hardware from time to time, so it's always helpful for things like that. And you get some cool bonuses. Discord chat. We got monthly live streams, BTS content. In fact, the Discord community is a great place for the BTS content these days. So if that's where you want to see, like, Steve's shed building projects and my not shed building projects.
To be fair, I haven't done one for a little while. Maybe I should build one.
You're building like a deck under the deck.
Yeah, I haven't done much BTS on that. A little bit, but I'll probably do. I'm going to have to now because we've advertised that.
I think we're now legally obligated to do that now. Yeah, so
you should stop talking. So before Tim legally creates any more legal obligations for me, we will end this episode because there's part three. So I don't know what I'm going to have to build in part three. We'll wait and find out.
Yeah, I'll rope you into a few more things, I guess.
Thanks. Cool. Well, we talked about Float Plane Patreon, didn't we? If we haven't, you know what it is by now, surely. Links to the video description. Thanks for watching. I'm your host, Steve.
I'm your host, Tim.
See you next time.